Ethics, and Rules. And I see we've been joined by Senator Devlin. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 480. And did you, Senator, wish to testify on both bills at the same time, or can we do them one at a time?
Madam Chair, that would probably be preferable.
Okay, I will also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1049.
Madam Chair, the Senate Bill 480 requires children 1 year of age and persons who weigh 20 pounds or less riding in a motor vehicle to be properly secured with a child safety system in a rear-facing position. I would note that the catch line, which says that requires 13-year-olds to ride a back, that was amended out by Senate amendments, but it stays in the catch line, so it's an error that the bill does not include that provision presently. And then on Senate Bill 1049, it redirects the Board of Boiler Rules civil penalty monies from the General Fund to the Department of Consumer and Business Services Building Codes Division for administration and enforcement of laws governing boilers and pressure vessels.
Good morning, Senator Devlin. I know you have other places to go and people to see, so we'll let you testify on both of these bills. And
1049.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to testify on both in support of both bills. I will tell you that my testimony on 480 will be a lot longer than my testimony on 1049, but I want to give you some clear background on why 480 is before you. Senate Bill 40 comes to you from the Senate floor on a 22-5 vote, with three members excused. I would like to start out my testimony this morning with a true story. In June 1996, a young mother came home to Washington from Japan, where her husband was the Pacific editor for Stars and Stripes. She left her daughter with her parents. She borrowed her parents' Dodge Raider and took her 4-year-old son, Anton, with her to visit friends in central Washington. As she left home, Anton's grandmother buckled the 4-year, 50-pound child into a safety belt and harness. Under Washington law at that time, Anton was old enough and weighed too much for a child car seat. While driving on a particularly desolate stretch of I-82, a semi-truck passed her and a gust of wind caused the vehicle to drift onto the shoulder. That was the last time she remembers seeing her son alive. The vehicle wheels bit into the volcanic ash and sand, and the vehicle rolled over 3 times. When law enforcement found her in the vehicle, she was critically injured but alive. The seatbelt and shoulder belt where Anton was sitting was still buckled, but Anton was not there. Anton was, in fact, lying on the highway. He had been thrown from the vehicle. The vehicle had rolled over him, and he had died from massive head injuries. Anton's mother went on to become the nation's leading advocate for booster seats. It was her advocacy that led to my introduction of successful booster seat legislation in the 2001 legislative session. That legislation passed both chambers and became law with one single no vote out of both chambers. I am here today to ask that you improve that legislation. The amended legislation before you, which is significantly amended from the original bill, does only 2 things. It requires that a child 1 year of age or under, or weighing less than 20 pounds, be in a rear-facing infant seat. And it changes Oregon's current booster seat requirement from 6 years and 60 pounds to being for a child from 40 pounds to age 8, unless, in the most rarest of circumstances, and it is extremely rare, that a child by 8 has already reached the height of 4'9", which is about 1 out of every 400 children. By my estimate. With these changes, Oregon's law will be enhanced and Oregon's children will be better protected. This change follows a recent update to Anton's law, Washington State's booster seat law. With this passage, Senate Bill 480, Oregon's child occupant law, can be best understood by looking at a visual display, which is in one of the items that you have that we handed out. We were known a little bit on the Senate floor on this particular item for passing out, we used up more timber than probably anybody imaginable. The law simply would be now that a child 1 year of age or under or weighing less than 20 pounds are required to use a rear-facing seat. Children between 20 and 40 pounds would be required to use a forward-facing child safety seat, which is the seat most of us that have had children over the last 20 years most familiar with. And then between 40 pounds and up to 8 years of age are required to use a booster seat with a lap and shoulder belt, except if the child has already reached the height of 4'9". Colleagues, child support requirements for vehicles are very important. Each year, 1,600 child occupants age 14 and under die in motor vehicle crashes, and close to 228,000 are injured as occupants of motor vehicles. Motor vehicle accidents remain a leading cause of unintentional injury and death for Oregon's children ages 1 through 14. Both rear-facing child safety system and booster seats are extremely important. Rear-facing child restraint systems are the most effective child systems for infants, especially in frontal crashes. You have to understand that in an infant seat that's rear-facing, it's primarily the back shell of the seat that actually provides the support in the crash. That's obviously because infants do not have very developed bone structure and are extremely fragile. Booster seats are absolutely necessary for children over 40 pounds and under the age of 8. Children these sizes do not properly fit into an adult shoulder lap belt. A proper fit shoulder and lap belt means the lap belt should be low on the hips and shoulder strap should cross the body in the middle of the shoulder and sternum. As early as the 1960s, and I'm only going to go on here a little bit longer, Madam Chair, something called safety belt syndrome was identified. Safety belt syndrome is when, children are especially vulnerable to this. These are injuries to the intra-abdominal organs that are less protected, and they also, because simply that the structure of the child's body is less developed. So some of the most traumatic injuries can occur from infants that even if they are this age, but they are just in a safety belt. The abdominal injuries can be extremely severe, and I think there might be other people later who will clearly identify that. Also, I would like to identify, in 2001, Oregon's booster seat usage was only 18%. With the passage of Oregon's booster seat law, usage grew to 29% in 2002 and 52% in 2006. SB 480 puts a child in the appropriate restraint system for their size. It will also make Oregon eligible. Unlike many bills, this bill actually gives the state more money. It will also make Oregon eligible to receive almost $500,000 this biennium from the federal government to improve child occupant safety instruction, and also probably approximately about another $1 million in 2009. I'd just like to close with just a couple of really short stories. Tamara Franks, a person who now works as a child passenger safety instructor, wrote me in February 2007 that in 2004 she was driving a minivan. While she was waiting to make a right-hand turn, her vehicle was struck from behind by a four-door sedan going 55 miles per hour. She survived. Her 6-year-old son and 4-year-old daughter were seated in the rear seat. Both were using booster seats. Both walked away uninjured. Officer Brett Barnum, who I don't know if he'll be here today, he was at the previous hearing, from the Portland Police Bureau, in a memo dated February 2007, described a two-car accident involving a Jeep Grand Cherokee and a Toyota Matrix. That's a little bit of quite a bit of a difference in size. The Toyota failed to stop at an intersection and was T-boned by the Jeep. The Jeep hit the Toyota on the driver's side and driver passenger side. The driver of the Toyota, who was properly restrained, and her 5-year-old grandson, who was in the booster seat, walked away uninjured. The officer said that not a scratch, cut, nick, or seatbelt burn could be found on the child's body. Colleagues, this particular bill, I think, is very good legislation. If you want to leave this legislature knowing that you've made a difference in a child's life or a parent's life, I think this is an ideal piece of legislation to cite. I would hope to have your support.
Committee members, I think before we go into a bill that bears no relation to this topic, I'll see if there are any questions for Senator Devlin on Senate Bill 480. Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I just want to thank you. My wife has been extremely adamant about this with our child, who's now just turning 8, and I'm sitting here feeling a tremendous amount of guilt for the amount of times I said, oh, come on, it's not that big a deal. It is a big deal. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the other committee member with an 8-year-old, I also appreciate this. I especially appreciate the change here. I think it's significant, changing from the pounds to the, at least for the older kids, to the height issue. Because I have an 8-year-old that is tall, and she actually got to, I mean, there are younger kids who may well be dense and fit the pound requirements.
I like the word dense.
But when that neck belt hits you too high, it doesn't matter. It really is. The height is a significant factor, so I appreciate you including that. Very good standard.
Okay. Looks like that's all of our questions for Senate Bill 480. Would you like to go on and talk about Senate Bill 1049?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I'm going to really change here. Senate Bill 1049 comes to you from the Senate floor, obviously passed the Senate floor. It is a very simple bill. It is probably one of the simplest bills that you will consider in this legislative session. Senate Bill 1049 cleans up some issues with the Board of Boiler Rules' ability to receive money from civil penalties. What SB 1049 does is simply amend the necessary provisions of ORS so that money received from civil and penalties imposed by the Board of Boiler Rules or money received by the Department of Consumer and Business Services will be deposited to the Consumer and Business Services Fund rather than the General Fund. This money is then specifically directed to go to the administration enforcement of the Board of Boiler Rules. This will enable the Board of Boiler Rules to be treated like the other boards within the Buildings Codes Division. This is not actually, the Board of Boiler Rules is the exception here. All of the other boards keep their civil penalties for their enforcement actions, like the Structures Board, the Electrical and Elevator Board, the Mechanical Board, the State Plumbing Board, etc. This is simply making them treated the same as others. And just a side here, boilers are not a thing of the past by any means, because I think you'll find some modern structures that still use steam and boilers. But boilers are also well known to any of you that have older school buildings, because many older school buildings are heated by boilers. Boilers need to be inspected. They are rarely inspected now because there are so little resources to inspect them. This will give the Board of Boiler Rules just a little bit more resources to be able to do this work.
Any questions on this bill? Yes, yeah. Representative Thatcher.
I appreciate the fact that you brought up that all other boards keep their fines for enforcement. That's what I was wondering. I felt really, really uncomfortable saying that here you can go out and force, and now you've got an incentive to enforce and fine because you're going to get to keep that in your own organization. And I guess I still am discomforted by that. But you're saying that all other boards do that, and
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think that's the immediate reaction that almost all legislators have. And that's because, obviously, they feel like the people that are enforcing something shouldn't be benefiting from the fines from it. The reality is that the fines in these cases are relatively minimal. And the reality is that we have very little resources to give these bodies to carry out the work that they're required to do under law. I mean, that's our choice also. But this will simply give them about an additional $45,000 this biennium, and probably, because it's not effective until 1 year through in the middle of the biennium, a little bit of an agreement with the co-chairs. It's not effective until 1 year into the biennium, and it'll give them about $90,000 probably the following year, following the biennium.
Thank you. And maybe explain to me, if somebody is fined by the board and they don't agree with the fine, is there an appeal process that they can go through to fine?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, this would probably be a question for somebody that would follow after me when the chair reopens this hearing.
Okay. Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it is a good bill. We do need to have the inspectors having my college days, I managed an apartment house in Seattle and had to get my boiler license because we had an old boiler in that building. And I think people don't understand, you know, keeping the, it was a diesel boiler, so you have to keep the nozzles correct. You got to do a lot of other kinds of things. And if you don't, you risk a lot of different problems, not only pollutions going into the air, but, and ours is hot water as opposed to steam, which is much easier, but there's a lot of issues with that. And as older buildings, especially in schools, get going, they keep the boiler working because it's also oftentimes the hot water heater for other things. But they have to cut off systems because they get clogged up and other things happen. And making sure that these things are working appropriately and having the inspections is important for the safety and health of those buildings and people. So, good idea.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We do have other legislators in the room on other bills, and so we're going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 480. We will be coming back to it. On 1049, we do only have one person signed up to testify, and that's Ron Murray. And are you good with... Do you need to testify, or are you just basically agreeing that it's a good bill?
Well, it's a great bill.
Okay. And I think we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1049. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1049.
Madam Chair.
And Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1049 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves Senate Bill 1049 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And will the committee assistant... Who we know is not Shauna. Please call the roll.
Aye.
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 No. Aye. Motion carries. And do we have a volunteer to carry this
Ruben
on the floor?
Ruben is boilers.
Representative Roblin, thank you very much.
The boiler maker. Madam Chair, would you mind clarifying the vote for our... We're doing a committee report upstairs for you, and we'd like to make sure we get the vote correct on that. I have 6-1-0. Is that what we have?
I believe so, with Representative Thatcher voting no.
Thank you. That's okay.
Okay, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1049, and I will open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 18A, and I'll call Representative Greenlick, who's in the audience, and we'll be changing administrators for this bill. Good morning. Sandy, would you like to tell us about this bill?
Sure, Representative.
Welcome to the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Musical chairs.
It is. It'll be a fun morning. Members of the committee, HJR 18 comes to you from the House Healthcare Committee. It is a joint resolution that is proposing to amend the Constitution, declaring that access to health care is a fundamental right of every legal resident in Oregon. You have... Behind your staff measure summary, you should have a fiscal on the A engrossed, which just basically reflects that the expense of putting it on the ballot, that is an itemization of that. You also should have the -A10 amendments and a copy of the A engrossed resolution. And I believe Representative Greenlick will speak to the amendments for you.
Great. Thank you very much. And good morning, Representative Greenlick. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm very pleased to be here to speak on behalf of the A-10 amendments and House Joint Resolution 18 as amended. I was a faculty person in the College of Pharmacy at Wayne State University in the late 1950s, and I remember a formative moment where I was... lecturing a class, as a young instructor, and talking about some modest health care bill that was being suggested in Washington. It was a predecessor. It was called the Ferran Bill. It was a predecessor to Medicaid. And I was giving what at that time was the traditional professional line, that I was speaking about health care as a right and as dangerous, socialized medicine and all this kind of stuff. And as I was talking, it struck me that what I was saying didn't make a great deal of sense. It was one of those embarrassing things when you're in the middle of a lecture and come to the conclusion that what you're saying is wrong. You don't quite know what to do with it. And I certainly didn't know what to do with it as a 23-year-old instructor. But it was a formative moment because it got me really thinking about the question of do Americans have the right to health care as a matter of right, as a special right, as we have the right to public education and to safety and a variety of other things that are guaranteed to us. At that time, it would not have been consensus of the population that access to health care was a right, about 50 years ago. But as time has emerged, the attitudes have changed, and it's particularly changed as it's become more difficult to make sure we have access to health care. In the late 50s, after World War II, where health care came out of World War II almost as an accident, as a measure of employment, your expectation was you would graduate from high school or you graduate from college and you go get a job with Ford Motor or U.S. Steel or a big insurance company. You'd spend your life working there, as my father did, working 45 years for the New York Central Railroad. And health insurance would be a part of employment. And it became a problem when you retired. You fell off that, and that got us to Medicare in the early 60s because we were all used to that, and the expectation is that's how you would get health care. And by the mid-70s, we had essentially reached universal access, with about 94% of the population having health insurance, mostly as a part of employment. But employment life has changed, and we've now reached the point where we have, in the nation, about 17% of the population without access to health insurance, and therefore with difficult access to health care, to effective and affordable health care. And when you now study the American people, and I've done a set of polls on a similar measure to this. I spent the last 18 months, as some of you know, before the session started, trying to put an initiative on the ballot, the HOPE initiative, which was very similar to this. Finding out how large a number 145,000 is, which is how many signatures we needed to put that on the ballot. About 70% of the Oregon population believes that health care is a right and that it's something that the legislature ought to do something about. What's different about this session is we are producing plans, and I expect we'll get Senate Bill 329 before us, which is designed to do what the second part of this statement is, to create a plan to provide that every legal resident of the state has access to affordable and effective health care. But as we address the problem of access, the problem of cost of the system, the problem of manpower, the problem of distributing health care across the state, it's always seemed very important to me to put the conceptual basis underneath that, to be able to ask the citizens, do they really believe that health care is a right? I mean, if the polling is correct, about 70% of the citizens will say, yes, we do believe health care is a right, and that as we put that in the Constitution, it will make, I think, life clearer for us as we come back in February of 2008 or in January of 2009 to begin to seriously address what it takes to move us incrementally in that direction. So the language of the A-10 amendments is language that's been worked out carefully with the Speaker's office and with others. We had no opposition in the initiative work. We worked with no opposition, and many civic and professional organizations, such as the Metropolitan Alliance for the Common Good in Portland, various union groups, various health action groups, ecumenical ministries, a variety of groups backed us in that proposal, and I suspect will back us as we attempt to pass this if we put it on the ballot by referral by action of the House and of the Senate. So I urge you to adopt the A-10 amendments and to move H.J.R. 18 amended that way to the floor of the House for action.
Okay, questions for Representative Greenlick? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Representative.
Good morning.
Good morning. Health care. I guess there's a whole big spectrum of what is defined as health care. Do you want to expound on that, what you're intending here?
Well, what I intend, and I think when we get Senate Bill 329 or Senate Bill 27, either of them, but I think 329 is the one most likely to come. It's passed out of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means and is on its way to the full committee. We're really talking about incremental care, and we're talking about two things. We're talking about how do you pay for it, which is the insurance issue, and we're talking about how do we make sure everybody has access at least to primary care. When we were working on House Bill 3097, which is a bill to look at some experimental ways to deliver care in the communities, I raised the question in a discussion that I'm a member of Kaiser. So when I get sick, I know what to do. I have a phone number to call. I talk to an advice nurse. I have a door to go in. I go to an acute care clinic. But if you don't have health insurance, you don't know what to do. And somebody said, oh, yes, you do. You follow the blue sign with an H on it and show up in the emergency room, which, of course, is what happened because of federal law. Emergency rooms need to provide care. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So we have to find a way to make sure people know how to get access to care. We have to find out a way to make sure we have the health manpower. I mean, we have to find out a way to make sure the care has high quality, and we're working on all those pieces. But underlying it, in order to give us, I think, the legitimacy to really address those questions, we have to accept the responsibility for creating an incremental plan for moving us in that direction. And health insurance is the first, I think, is the first piece of that. But all these things make up the healthcare system, and it's very complicated. And even if I had a magic wand, Representative Thatcher, I couldn't wave that wand and create the perfect healthcare system. But we need to get to work on it, and I think that's what this is in aid of.
Thank you. And when it says in this A-10 amendment, I may say it in the other two, but it just says, where's the other part? Establish a system of a law, established by law, a system designed to provide to every legal resident of the state access to effective and affordable health care. What do you mean by legal resident?
I mean somebody who's not here illegally.
The reason I asked, Madam Chair, because I think there might be a little difference between legal resident just shows that you actually live at that address in Oregon, and then there's people who are legally present. I think there might be a little bit of a definition issue if that's what you're intending. So I just wondered if we should.
Well, I'm intending not to have that definitional problem.
Is that right?
We didn't put citizen because there are legal residents who are here who live here legally, and we intended to include those in this. So, no, we're not. I mean, we're not including people. Although we have to figure out how to make sure they have health care along the way, we're not including people in this who are illegal aliens in the state.
Okay, thank you.
It's not to say that we ought to let them die on the street simply because they're illegal, but that's a different question. It's not dealt with here.
Other questions for Representative Greenlick? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this, and I hope you'll move it along.
I think you may get your wish here. I will close the public hearing on HJR 18. And I'll open a work session on HJR 18.
Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the A-10 amendments to House Joint Resolution 18.
Representative Buckley moves the -A-10 amendments to HJR 18. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 18 as amended to the floor with a to adopt recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves House Joint Resolution 18 as amended to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I will be supporting the motion to move this to the floor, retaining my right to vote differently on the floor.
Thank you. And Representative Thatcher.
I still have some outstanding questions. I thought maybe there'd be more testimony, but I will be a no for now.
Okay. Further discussion? And please call the roll.
Representative
Beckles? Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Aye. The motion carries. And we will ask Representative Greenlick to carry this on the floor. Thank you very much. And I'll close the work session on HJR 18 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3563. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Chip Shield, State Representative, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. And Representative Barker is here with me as well, and he will also talk on the bill. House Bill 3563 is a compromise bill. It's a rewrite of Senate Bill 856A, which had bipartisan support in the Senate, including Senator Morris, Winters, Nelson, and it passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously, including with the support of Senator Byer and Senator Cruz. As chair of the Public Safety Committee, this bill grew out of our belief that we needed to focus a little more intently on maximizing our public safety investments. And we wanted to make sure that we're getting the right mix of investments in intervention and prevention, analyze whether or not we're getting the right mix of investments in treatment and programs that reduce subsequent recidivism of offenders. Are we getting the proper mix to maximize deterrence and prevent crime? Are we maximizing the use of local jail beds? Are we maximizing our sentencing policy to most effectively improve public safety? I believe these are proper questions for the legislature to ask. I also want to let you know that the District Attorneys Association, is my understanding, is neutral on the bill, as is Crime Victims United. We went into some significant negotiations with Representative Barker and Crime Victims United to work this compromise to bring people along and make everyone happy. You should have in front of you the Dash 2 amendments that we would ask you to move into the bill. And with that, I would ask you to move the amendments and send it on to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. And now I'd like to hand it over to Representative Barker.
thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jeff Barker, House District 28. Representative Shields worked very hard on the bill. He had the original bill he was working on, and we discussed it and worked closely with Crime Victims United to get a bill that we believed would work. And Representative Shields really worked hard to reach a compromise bill that would work, and I believe we've done that here. This bill is intended to have people take a true look at the system that Representative Shields just described in a prejudged manner. We want to really have people that are not obstructionists, not advocates for one way or another, but people to sit down and take a look and try to analyze these things and see what's best for Oregon, best for, that says it all right there, just what's best for Oregon. And again, I want to compliment Representative Shields on really bending over backwards trying to reach the compromise to get this bill updated and done. And I would join him in requesting you put the Dash 2s in and move this on with a due pass. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, good representatives. Explain to me what you mean on the front of the bill, front page, line 14 and 15. State-funded programs, including but not limited to child development programs. Child development is one of those programs, is one of those enormous catch-alls, and I'm wondering what you're referring to there. You could spend, you know, years studying child development programs that are funded by public agencies.
One of the things we talked about was we wanted to take a look at things like Head Start, those kind of programs, and what does that have to do with hay fever's getting me today. Excuse me. What that has to do with prison time down the road. what kind of child development programs will keep people from turning to a criminal life. Those are the kind of things they want to look at.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that within the education community, this has been something that has been controversial and studied. I don't know what your timeline and funding here is, but you could barely graze the surface of this issue, and I'm really a little disturbed that it's in here, because you're opening a door on something that is far bigger than I think your vision is.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, your point's well taken. I think the intent of those lines is not that we would conduct evaluations to see whether or not Head Start works. It's that, particularly in the state of Washington, the Washington Institute for Public Policy has really done a cost-benefit analysis already to show that investments up front can decrease crime down the road. What we would mostly be looking at is, are we investing enough dollars into these programs up front, and more along the lines of what would be the proper public interest in funding, how much money should we put into them in order to defer prison beds down the road. It would build off of past research.
Okay, thank you for your answer.
Other questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we have no one else signed up to testify on this bill, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3563. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 3563. Members, this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move a -2 amendments to House Bill 3563.
Representative Buckley moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 3563. Is there discussion? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3563 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Yeah, move it to Ways and Means with a due pass. Representative Buckley moves House Bill 3563 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Well, I guess I just feel a little uncomfortable saying that it almost looks like this bill is biased towards looking at only social programs, not the whole picture. Looking at social programs for reducing crime, and it just seems like we're just looking for ways to... expand government. I don't know. I guess it's almost looking like people who are served best by government are less likely to become criminals, and that's what I'm. It's rather than looking at people's families, looking at, you know, giving people the responsibility to raise their children and creating an environment to allow them to be home with their children to guide them. I don't know. It just seems like it just is biased towards a big government. That's the only thing that solves the problem. And so
yes, Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm very much supportive of this bill. The idea that we'd actually look at our state-funded programs, which is the focus of the bill, how are we spending state money, and what is the result of the expenditure of that money, that, to me, is, I think, the center of the bill. And if there is a way to spend the tax dollars that we have more efficiently to actually get better results, that's something I think that we're constantly trying to accomplish in the legislature.
Further discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair. I am very bothered by the language that I pointed out in here, that this is way too broad in its scope. But it does have some structure around how much money they're going to be able to spend. And so I don't think they're going to get anywhere near where this broad language would lead them to think they're going. I will give it an aye vote to send it down to Ways and Means, knowing that Ways and Means doesn't have very much money left to open the door here very far. But I am on record, and I hope you understand that these are things that have been studied far more extensively than this study will, in terms of the result of certain educational programs on future
issues, and we'll continue to study as we must. This, I think, is intended to be more narrowly focused, but it doesn't really say that in here. So I'm bothered by it, but I will give it a vote two ways and means.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My feeling is that it is crafted in such a way that we will look at reports and others. There's not enough money here to go out and do it, but there is enough money to say, in relationship to that, how is Oregon doing? And where there are proven programs that have been there, we can look at those programs and say, are we doing the things we should that would pay these benefits? Because other people have shown us that those benefits exist. And I think that is a good thing for us to know when we make public policy later on. So I'm fully in favor of this bill. I think it's a good deal. I think the developmental stuff early on has shown in report after report, state after state, that it pays dividends. We don't really know what that means in Oregon. How many kids would we be saving? I think you can extrapolate from other reports to make some of those comments, and I think that's what they're intending to do. And I would love to see that for Oregon.
Further comments? Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a start. It's kind of like Yogi Berra used to say, you know, if you don't know where you're going to go, you may end up someplace you don't want to be. This is a start towards that. Hopefully we can at least get out of this some kind of a vision process to where we want to be at least. So, therefore, I'm fully supportive of this.
Okay. Andy, would you please? We're on a motion to send House Bill 3563 to Ways and Means as amended with a due pass recommendation. And Andy, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3563. And I think we have a couple of legislators here to talk about 2814. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2814. Hi, Jim. Could you please tell us about House Bill 2814?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2814 comes to this committee from the Joint Committee on Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy. It appropriates money from the General Fund to the Department of Human Services to bolster preparedness in the event of pandemic influenza, including purchase of personal protective equipment, influenza vaccine, antiviral drugs, and provisions for personnel for training and supply distribution. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Good morning, Representative Boone, Representative Boquist.
Good morning.
Tell us about this bill.
For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and this is a great bill. This bill came out of my committee, and the only reason we're here in front of your committee is we feel so great about it. We even sent a unanimously signed memo to the chair asking her to hear this. But really, it was because our committee was closing that day and it needed a hearing. But we really want to share this with you. Representative Boquist brought this bill to our committee, and our Committee on Emergency Preparedness is working very hard to prepare our state for any emergency, which and some that we know will be here. And this was very timely. It came about the time we're all hearing about different flus, et cetera, and most recently issues of people and transmitting diseases via airplane air. And I suppose the same could be said for Capital Air, too. So when this started out, it was a little bit different, and there were some issues with it, but Representative Boquist worked very hard with our state top doc, Dr. Allen, and other people, and came out with this bill, which I think is a great start, at least, to get us prepared for something that we know we're going to face. And if this legislature can see fit to get a couple of our bills out of here, it would be great. I'm going to let him talk a little bit more in detail about this bill, but we wholeheartedly support this, and this is something that came up actually in last interim when it was just the Emergency Preparedness Committee. So this is something that came forward to this joint committee, and we're very happy to support it.
Great. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Brian Boquist, State Representative, 23rd House District, and I thank my distinguished colleague to the right. And we've been working on this bill and other emergency preparedness bills over the last year and a half, almost. And if you're not familiar, pandemic is one of the four issues that emergency preparedness covered, the others being terrorism, earthquake, which, remember, we did things about, and tsunami, which we've done things about in this legislative session. Just very briefly, because I think the administrator explained what the bill does, is let me give you quick background, and I'm going to read some information out of a letter exchanged between the governor and myself back in February, just to let you know the type of pandemic that we're trying to prepare for. And this information actually comes from an analysis from the CDC and the Health and Human Services based on known events. And those of you who aren't old enough to remember the Spanish flu, I think that's all of us, that happened in 1917-1918, and of course there's not much in the history books because the First Amendment didn't apply during World War I and there was censorship. So nobody knew about it even though it happened. A pandemic forecast for the state of Oregon, when this happens, not if it, will put about 1 million Oregonians ill over a 6-week to 3-month period. In addition to that, we can anticipate that 40% absenteeism across the board over the same period of time. 112,000 of our citizens will require hospitalizations, and we've heard issues on health care before here. We don't have 112,000 beds in the state of Oregon. And about 16,935 of those Oregonians will require ICU, and we have less than 900 beds of ICU, even if we use every emergency shelter that we have in the state of Oregon. The bottom line is that we can anticipate somewhere around 21,677 Oregonians dead. Again, 21,677 Oregonians dead. That's if we do everything right. Having said that, what we're trying to do now is start the preparation for this. In this session, we saw $1 million spent for tree insurance. In my district alone, we spent $25 million for an overpass to save 7 lives. And we're talking about 22,000 lives here in the state of Oregon. The counter argument that has come out on this bill multiple times, and we've put to bed in the other committees, and I want to bring it up here, a simple quote from the Secretary of Health and Human Services, because everybody says, well, the federal government will come help us. And rather than go into that debate, which lasted multiple hearings, I'll just give you a simple quote from the Secretary of Health and Human Services from the federal government, and I quote, "I need to say with clear and unwavering voice that any community that fails to prepare with the expectation that somehow the federal government will have a resource to ride in and save the day will be sorely disappointed." So the feds aren't coming to help us. As was mentioned, it was the last day. It was part of my error and part of scheduling and discussion, and we didn't get this referred down to Ways and Means, and I take the blame for that. And the distinguished co-chairs and the speaker and the president were kind enough to refer it to you because of our error at our end. And so it sits down before you right now. I would mention again that there is a letter with all 10 signatures, 5 senators, 5 House members, Democrats and Republicans, all supporting the issue of send this down to Ways and Means and let them determine how much we can spend for this preparation. And I would note that there are senior members of the majority party that are anticipating and waiting for this to come down. It's not a surprise to them, and in fact, they've been in my office too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the representatives? Yes, Representative Roblin.
More of a comment than a question. My great aunt, this 1918 was one of pivotal moments in her life. She was living in San Francisco, and the park across the street became one of the hospitals for that city because there was no room. And she remembers bodies being piled up and people coming and tents set up. And she says no one should ever have to go through that again. And she would not leave her room, said you wouldn't leave your house. People stayed in. It was unbelievable at the time. And it was one of those events. And when she was 98 years old, she could still talk about that particular moment in her life and how absolutely horrifying it was to be in a place with as many people, all of them sick. So I think it's an important thing that we deal with, recognizing it does happen from time to time. And if we can be prepared, she said she certainly was never prepared for what she had to deal with and see. And I think from the description we've had today, we're going to end up with parks being used the same way.
Further discussion? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I also believe that individuals, families, communities, everybody needs to do what they can and not expect somebody else to come and save the day. I was just looking at this. I don't know if you distributed it or what, but it's from printed from a Willamette Week article dated March 7th, 2007. And it says that 33 states have ordered their full allocation and 11 others want more than their full amount. And that leaves Oregon as one of six states pursuing a contrarian policy. Was there any reason given for us pursuing a contrarian policy, if that's the case?
Madam Speaker, good representative. There are contrary views medically back and forth. I think what we all agree is that we need to work together to prepare for it, which is why we have this bill here to get us out of those six and get us up into the top upper tier. And I think that's the easiest way. We spent, I think, an entire hearing discussing this one, too, which was multiple hours. I'd be happy on the side to discuss it with you if you have a couple of hours.
Okay. See no further questions for you. Thank you very much, both of you, for bringing this to us. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2814. Open a work session on House Bill 2814. Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2814 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
And it's already been amended. So I don't think we even have to say that.
In gross version.
In gross form. Okay. Representative Berger moves House Bill 2814A to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Andy, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Motion carries. And the bill moves to Ways and Means. I will close the work session on House Bill 2814. And I'll reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 480. And members, we are excused, at least for the time being, from the floor session. And we have several witnesses signed up to testify on this bill. We'd like to try to move it out today, so if you could please keep your comments as brief as possible. That will enable us to take it up in a work session. Okay. So first we'll call Brett Barnum, Dr. James Lace, and Ruth Hirschfield. And we also have Troy Costellas, so perhaps the four of you could come forward and we'll take your testimony in whatever order you wish to speak. Please go ahead.
Sure, I'll go ahead. Hi. For the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here from Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and the Safe Kids Coalition of Oregon. And very briefly, I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 480. And I think I'll just stop that, keep my testimony very short. You have my written comments there, and I have nothing else to add other than what I think you'll hear here and what Senator Devlin has already given you in terms of background information. We encourage you to pass this, though. And it's all about prevention, and we like to make sure that the kids in this state are safe. And MVA, motor vehicle accidents, are the leading cause of death of kids in this state still.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Ruth Hirschfield. I'm the Executive Director for ACTS Oregon and the Child Safety Seat Resource Center in Oregon. And we're a private nonprofit promoting traffic safety. And a lot of the services that we provide include access to information on child passenger safety. We receive over 5,000 calls a year. And within that, a lot of questions around booster seats and how to best protect our children. What we find from a lot of those families is that they look to Oregon law as an example of what is best practice. And so we are supportive of this change. We think that it'll make a big difference. My testimony, again, you have in front of you. I think part of what we've talked about is just the risks of abdominal injuries, and we have charts that show that children between the ages of 4 and 8 are at the highest risk if they're not belted using a booster, and also that booster seats do provide the best protection for that age group as opposed to being unrestrained or being restrained with a seatbelt system. I'm a child passenger safety instructor. There's a national certification that we teach, and we have over 400 certified technicians in Oregon. They are all trained to support best practice. Best practice is children up to age 8 or 4 foot 9 in booster seats. So this law would, the change in the law would really make it a consistent message to our citizens, and I think that's what they're looking for. So I thank you, and I encourage you to support this bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Brett Barnum. I'm a police officer with the City of Portland. I have been a police officer in the state of Oregon for over 16 years. You have my testimony there in front of you. I come before you today as a representative of over 900 men and women of the Portland Police Bureau and over thousands of police officers statewide who support this bill. This bill touches me in a certain way. I have two boys that are 8 and, that are 10 and 12. They grow so quickly. And,
hopefully not while you've been waiting.
Exactly.
For this committee.
And, again, like I said, I am lead officer in our occupational safety program. I'm a child safety seat installer, technician, instructor. I've got several years of occupational safety training. We as police officers in the state of Oregon are the first line of defense. You as the lawmakers are the first line of defense to help us out. If it isn't for us out there enforcing the law, educating citizens, and I really strongly encourage you to think about that. Education is key here. As a police officer, we have changed over the last 15 years, and I've seen a real change as far as education. That's a part of community policing. And that's how we spread the message. We rely on folks like Axe Oregon to help spread the message. We rely on our hospital staffs who allows these children to leave the hospitals after they're born. But it's law enforcement that's out there every day. I'm the one looking in your car. I'm the one making sure that Representative Hunt has his 8-year-old properly secured, that Representative Buckley has his 8-year-old properly secured. They see firsthand exactly what I see. I put my 10-year-old in a booster seat, who still sits in a booster seat because he's 4'7". He doesn't fit in our cars without the booster seat. My 12-year-old stands 4'10". Just those 3 inches makes all the difference in the world. And as Representative Hunt said earlier with Senator Devlin's testimony, it's not about weight. It's about height. We have to protect these children. These are the people who rely on us to protect them. They don't know any better, and we all know that. And is it an inconvenience to take a child seat from one car to the other or to have this big plastic thing in your car? Yes. But is it a lifesaver? Absolutely. That's what we need to spread the message on. And to me, it's a no-brainer. If we can improve an existing law that we have to improve those for those people who rely on us to protect them, it makes all the sense in the world. And this bill is, the 900 men and women of the Portland Police Bureau, the thousands of police officers in the state of Oregon who I attend conferences with, they all support this bill. As far as I'm concerned, it's a no-brainer. And I've included some pictures, some real-life pictures in my written testimony. Now, these crashes that Senator Devlin talked about earlier, I responded to. These are low-speed crashes. We're not talking about the Kennewick crash that he was talking about with Anton Scalene, who was killed, tragically killed. We don't need to have somebody, some child tragically killed in our state in order to bring legislation before you to call it Anton's Law, as they did in Washington. We don't need that. We need Senate Bill 480. Let's just call it Senate Bill 480. Let's not attach a name to it. We have to move forward with this. We have to be progressive instead of retroactive. And that's what this bill is. It's progressive. It takes us to the next level with all the data we've collected, with all the crashes that I've seen throughout my 16 years. And again, those two crashes that I provided to you with some pictures, which I apologize are a little grainy, but these are low-speed crashes. These are things I see every day as a police officer in the city of Portland, the major metropolitan city in our state. And I go to these traffic crashes 2 and 3 times a day. And when there's children involved, it touches my heart because I think about my kids. And are my kids properly protected? And if these kids aren't properly protected, one kid walks away in one of these crashes unscathed. The other kid, the other child, has some life-altering injuries. And it just makes sense. We need to educate people, but we need to start firsthand with changing the law. This makes sense. So, and I would highly encourage you to either email me, call me, anything else. I'd be more than happy to talk to you about, obviously, my personal feelings on the matter. But I'll sit down and talk with you for an hour or two, if that's what it takes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Casales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. From the administrative side of things, it's my office that would be the one that would receive the funds, as Mr. Sembridge pointed out, from the federal funds that would go towards education, go towards child safety seat technician training, go towards having available seats for low or no income families around the state to make sure that people that have children that may not have the resources for a seat or have a seat that's no longer usable, it's been in a crash or has been recalled, that there's something there that can protect the children. From the personal point of view, 10 years ago, on the night before Halloween, we were involved in a crash. My stepfather and my mother were in the front seat, my wife and I, and my five-year-old were in the back seat. Five-year-old was in a booster seat. We were hit from the side in a low-speed crash, front to front, back to back. We ended up in a residence home in their front yard. EMTs arrived on the scene, and my five-year-old was in a booster seat, even though it was a lap-only situation. But the main thing they talked about is if he had not been in that booster seat, that lap belt probably would have caused internal injuries because of him only being 5 years old. It is a situation, unfortunately, that's replayed itself out over the state too many times, too often. And I know that on that evening when we put Paul in that seat, that was the second best hug that I could have given him. First was mine, second was the booster seat and the belt. And that's what this bill is all about, is making sure that we're protecting our kids, doing the right thing, and not giving the wrong impression to adults, grandparents, uncles, and aunts that just putting them in a belt and having something wrapped around is the right thing to do, because we want to avoid those tragedies, as the officer pointed out. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for these witnesses? Vice Chair Berger.
thank you. And I think this is for our traffic experts here and our violation experts. As I understand it, this bill does create a new violation, failure to properly use a seatbelt as opposed to just use or safety belt. And it says it's a Class D violation. What is a Class D? What's the...
Class D traffic violation is the lowest classification of violations. Currently, right now, it holds a $97 base fine, which is able to be reduced by the judges, depending on the circumstances. Also, too, parents in the city of Portland and throughout the state, there are safety belt education programs which are in line. I'm a presenter at the Legacy Manual Trauma Nurses Tough Talk. We allow folks and individuals who are not properly secured, whether it's an adult or a child, and we call it endangering child passenger, to attend this trauma systems class. Here again, we're trying to provide education for parents. They understand and realize at this point in time what is expected of them as adults, what the law requires, and the ways to properly secure their children and themselves in vehicles. So, and in exchange for attending this 2-hour, one-time safety seatbelt class, they have the citation dismissed. It doesn't go on the driving record, don't pay the fine. And it's adopted through several counties throughout our state. So it's a good way to work hand in hand with the community and provide that education that I'm talking about. That's very important.
Yeah, please, Madam Chair. Officer, isn't it true that in most cases you're not looking for this, you find this in conjunction with some other violation? In other words, I don't know how you, driving around Portland, can see how tall a child is. You could see a child who isn't in a safety seat, but seeing whether the safety seat is properly fitted would be tough.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, absolutely, it is tough. I actually, as a traffic officer, I ride a motorcycle. I have the advantage of having a little bit of height over most motor vehicles. And I also have the advantage of having maneuverability. I can drive right up next to the side of a violator's vehicle,
look right down inside the vehicle, and I can see. Having this training and experience, which we have two conferences throughout the state, statewide, our three flag safety belt conferences, which provide education to officers throughout the state on safety belt and occupational safety protection, we're versed in trying to be creative with our laws, not to try and necessarily inhibit somebody's rights, but as our law states, properly secure, which is the lap belt low across the thighs with the shoulder strap over the collarbone. If that shoulder strap is coming right behind a child's ear, that's very visible to me in a vehicle. And is that, in my opinion, properly secure? No. Will I stop that motor vehicle? Will I issue a citation? Probably not, but I'll provide some education to that driver at the time of the stop and explain to him that you need to boost your child up, which allows that lap shoulder belt to lay flatter over the collarbone, providing now that ultimate protection of that center body mass of that child. Also, too, we can also provide different ways to adjust the lap and shoulder belt on the pillars of the vehicles. So there's lots of very beneficial programs and trainings that we attend as officers, there again being the first line of defense to educate these motorists and provide them with the optimal protection for their children and for themselves.
Thank you, Officer. And I just have to make this comment. I am sure that contrary to testimony, you would never find Representative Hunt or Representative Buckley in violation.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I had to share a brief story. I was living in another state, and I was pulled over, and I thought, what in the world did I do? And came out of the car and gave me some sort of award for having my child buckled in properly in the back seat. Give me a heart attack. But I'm glad, Troy, you mentioned sitting in the middle seat. This wouldn't be now, I mean, sometimes you might have three children now with an expanded age group that's required to sit in the, one might be sitting in the middle seat without a shoulder belt because sometimes cars are not equipped with that. That would not be, I guess, now illegal, would it?
Madam Chair and Representative Thatcher, based on the belt assembly within the vehicles, if there's lap only, last session there was actually that exemption put in place because it's very difficult now to find seats that necessarily work with lap only situations. They're mostly built now. The booster seats are built for the 3-point versus just the lap belt. And so there was an exemption put into law already if there's a lap belt only that you would be able to fit it correctly. So the key is that's the proper fit, as Representative Berger pointed out. If the lap belt across the thighs and low, then that proper piece and the seat, they wash each other out. It's mainly for that one that comes up across the torso of the child.
Okay, thank you. I have a follow-up too. I'm thinking about my own situation. My own son, who's very tall, he's 5, he's 4 foot. He can go on those rides at the Seattle Center. He stood up on the little board. And he was very tall as a 1-year-old, too, and 9-month-old. I mean, he was long. And having him in a seat, I just remember him pushing on the seat, you know. I don't know. It made it real difficult after a certain point having him in a rear-facing child seat. And I just wondered if maybe the pediatrician might have some, Dr. Lace might have some comment on that. I understand the importance of having them in a rear seat, but sometimes it just seems like you would have sometimes a large child. He was pretty big.
I had a large child too, but you still take what the best options are that you have at that time. And so you want to pick out the safest, form of restraint, and the rear-facing car seat up until 20 pounds is still going to be your safest. And after 20 pounds and good head and neck control, that's when you can turn around. So that's the best way to look at that.
Follow up. And thank you for that, because it says in here, regardless of weight, in rear-facing.
Madam Chair, the benefit of having children riding rear-facing is to protect the head, neck, shoulders, and back. Having their feet touch the back of the seat in front of them is not a problem at all. Having their knees and their legs bent really is not impacting their safety in the vehicle. The law does include children rear-facing to a minimum of 1 year, And if at 1 year they're not yet 20 pounds, they need to continue to ride your face until they are 20 pounds. So when we talk with families that are calling us saying, my baby's feet are touching the back, can I turn them forward facing? My explanation is that really the intent of the child safety seat is to protect the head, neck, shoulders, and back, the most vulnerable parts of those children. And so you really want to continue to keep them rear facing as long as possible. And we talk about different seat options and things. But again, the rear facing recommendation has been a national recommendation for a number of years from the American Academy of Pediatrics and others. And we're just doing clarification in our law because in the past it's just said proper. It hasn't been specific to the infants. So what we're actually seeing now are infants riding rear facing to 14 months, 16 months, 18 months. In Europe, a lot of the laws and the seats accommodate children up to 2. So their heads remain the largest parts of their bodies until they're 2 and 3 years of age. The longer we can keep them rear facing, the safer they are. And helping families focus on the protection of the head, neck, and shoulders and less concern about their feet seems to make them feel more comfortable with what it is they're trying to accomplish.
And Representative Thatcher, I think, now I'll just verify this with Troy, but my reading of this bill on page 2, lines 24 and 25 say that if the rear seat of a vehicle does not have shoulder harnesses, then the provision for a child under 4'9" to be in a child safety seat does not apply. And that's really the law right now.
Okay.
This doesn't change that. So.
Okay.
Representative Berger.
I have one more question, and I think this might be for staff. In the summary up above, you said to require the first line, requires motor vehicle passenger under 13 years. That was removed.
Yes.
The last line of that, removes provision allowing drivers to transport more people in vehicle than vehicle's restraint system can accommodate. Is that still in here?
I don't think that's in. I don't remember that's being there.
But the middle two are.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. It will be amended before we... I mean, this will be corrected at some point.
Before it goes to the floor? Or?
Yeah. Because that is misleading and will cause...
Yeah, I had the same question because I always thought that they changed these little areas
yes.
at the top when the bill had been amended. We're not further amending the bill here today, though. So
I believe that you could recommend that it be reprinted.
Even though
if you were to pass, we'll verify that.
Yeah, thank you. I think it would probably save a lot of questions on the floor if we could correct the summary up above so it reflected the content of the bill. Did you need to make a further comment?
I'm sure that's absolutely correct. Those two items were amended out.
Okay. Further discussion? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 480, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 480. Vice Chair Buckley.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves Senate Bill 480A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay. Seeing none, Andy, please call the roll.
Madam Chair, I think what we will show in the action, and we'll talk to the Chief Clerk, is... that statement that goes into the action, even though you never say it, for an engross or for an amended bill where it says be reprinted, we'll make that statement in there if you'd like.
I think that would be helpful because I think that it is quite confusing for people to look at the first phrase of the.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure we said that before
before
you voted on it. So.
Okay, thank you. Andy, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And I see that Representative McPherson is the chief sponsor of this bill on the House side, so we'll ask him to carry it. If he does not wish to or can't for some reason, is there a volunteer who would like to carry the bill? I'm sure he probably will.
If he doesn't, Madam Chair, I'll do that. But
okay.
I'm sure the committee
can
have one.
Okay. And I'll close the work session. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 480. And members, we have one bill introduction to do today. We are going to carry over the other two bills on our agenda, which are Senate Bill 700, for which we continue to have new amendments almost hourly. And so we're going to look at those and make sure that they fit together. So we'll carry that over to our next hearing, which is tomorrow. We are meeting tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. And likewise, House Bill 2060, we'll carry that over to tomorrow's hearing.
So I think that just leaves us with a bill introduction, and do you have a draft for us, Jim?
This is legislative draft 3929. It has to do with something called the Lindsey Ball Research Hatchery. If anybody would like copies of the proposed legislation, I have it. Legislative draft 3929.
Members, I believe this is simply another draft of a piece of legislation that has already passed the House but has not yet been heard in the Senate. So,
Madam Chair, the bill that you had several weeks ago is in a Senate committee that is closed.
So a motion would be to introduce LC 3929 as a committee bill.
Is the motion, would you like that motion? Madam Chair, I move LC 3929 be submitted as a committee bill.
Okay. Representative Berger moves that LC 3929 be introduced as a committee bill from the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Okay, motion carries. The bill will be reintroduced as a committee bill. Okay, and with nothing further to come before us, committee
This is the two bills and the only thing that you haven't acted on, so we're pushing
Okay, committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.